welcome to another episode of Review Improve, a podcast dedicated to personal growth in the 21st century. I'm your host, Sam Rust, along with my co-host, Mr. Bradley Luce. Brad, you hanging from the chandeliers at the factory today? What's going on over in sunny Southern California?
Another day in paradise, you know, building $100,000 cars and moving technology one tire at a time.
Moving technology one tire at a time. There's a new one. Very good. The house hunt, how's that going for you recently?
I have an offer in today, actually. We'll see probably Wednesday whether they accept it or not. So hopefully, fingers crossed, Lord willing, all of the above.
Yeah, very good. That will be exciting. I'll look forward to tracking the progress. How many offers have you put in, just out of curiosity?
This is number 4.
Oh, okay, that's not as many as I would have thought. Okay.
It's still, as we discussed before, on mud huts, but the straw roof on this one is newer, so.
Oh, man.
Yeah, I know.
Clean straw. You're really stepping it up.
I know. It feels so good. How about you? How's the snow that you said you were going to get?
You know, it came, it went, and now it's just kind of settled into normal Colorado fall weather. Yeah, I've got a fairly busy week this week at Rust Automation, my normal 9-to-5 employer, having fun running around to a couple of different places. And then we're actually, Becca and I are running a church get-together, kind of a fellowship community dinner at our church on Friday. So doing quite a bit of work, making meals and things like that. Just to be clear, I'm not making meals. Becca's making the meal, which is a good thing for all concerned. But I'm fully supporting her by cheering her on. That's basically what's happening.
A real man will cook food.
Oh my goodness. Yeah, you're really making me squirm over here. So I can cook, I just choose not to.
Why?
Oh my goodness. Why? Because there's people in my life that do it better than I do.
We're going down a rabbit path that we should probably go down next time. We'll bring this up next episode.
And that's not an area that I need to improve in. There's other areas that I can grow in.
But sometimes other people would appreciate it if you helped out, you know?
And that's why God created barbecues.
We will have to bring this back up some other episode. This is getting way better.
Anyways, to bring us back onto the rails, today we are going through a new kind of book for us on the podcast. We've covered more philosophy style, kind of socially aware books. We've covered personal development books of various types. We've got leadership books. We've gone to entrepreneurial books. But today we're covering an autobiography, Shoe Dog, by Phil Knight. It's been out. It's a number one New York Times bestseller. I read it for the first time about 6 months ago. Really enjoyed it. Autobiographies for me are hit or miss. Some of them are okay, and it probably depends on the quality of the ghostwriter, honestly. But I really enjoyed this, and we're toying with going more towards some of these narrative style books. I think that there's a lot of fun application that can be pulled out of a real life historical book like this, especially on a company that's such a part of our culture today. So that's how we ended up doing this book. I'm curious to see how this episode flows and how it works, but I definitely enjoyed rereading the book a second time. Overall, your thoughts kind of as we start zooming into this book, Brad?
I'll start out with kind of introduction to the book and Phil Knight. So Phil Knight, he was born on February 24th, 1938. He was a graduate of the University of Oregon and Stanford Graduate School of Business. He ran track under the coach Bill Bowerman at the University of Oregon, and he also co-founded Nike with Bill Bowerman. Bill Bowerman, as a side note, was a very successful and famous track coach. He coached many Olympic athletes in track and in sports and just overall the athletic abilities. They agreed to a partnership by handshake to start their Blue Ribbon Sports Company, the original shoe company, in 1960.
Which I thought was just a hilarious name, Blue Ribbon Sports. I mean, I know he had to come up with it kind of on the spot, but that just kind of struck me as kind of humorous.
Yeah, we'll talk about that more later too. But just a side note on the title, shoe dogs are lifers, kind of like people who dedicate their life to everything shoes, how they're made, how they're designed, the material in them, the shape of the tracks, everything, like the color and the thread count of the ties. I mean, everything shoes.
I don't think I had known a shoe dog until about 3 years ago. And then I had a person come into my life that probably owns over 100 pairs of shoes and opened my eyes to how much people can love shoes. I had no idea. As a subculture that I had not been exposed to growing up. Fascinating with man, so many rabbit trails that you could go down. But anyways.
Yeah. Yeah. I actually just recently realized I work with several shoe dogs. One, he's a shoe dog because he realizes how much money he can make off of them. So he buys high-end like Nike shoes when they are released, waits until they no longer sell them, and then he marks up the prices by double or triple and sells them, makes bank. And the shocking thing is people buy them. He sells them like hotcakes. And then another guy I know, he is a shoe dog because he loves shoes. I mean, he'll buy them and maybe wear them once. If not, they just go on his shelf and he looks at them and talks about his collection of shoes.
Huh. That's very interesting.
It's interesting. I mean, in the book, he talks about how, when he was in his early 20s, he graduates from college and he decides, all right, I want to take a trip around the world. He was searching, kind of trying to figure out what he wants to do with his life, where he wants to go, who he was. So he's like, all right, I'm going to go a trip around the world. During the trip around the world, he goes in a lot of detail of the countries he visits, where he went, what he thought of it, what happened to him in those different countries. But every country he goes to, he's focused on shoes. What shoes people are wearing in this country, or what material they're made out of this country. And I thought it was interesting how as he was searching, it all went back to what he found, what he enjoyed, and what he was literally infatuated with shoes. And he didn't even know there's such a thing as a shoe dog, I think he got that term from people in Japan, was it?
I believe so, yeah. Well, and that's interesting. You kind of, in that trip, you quickly get to know Phil Knight, and it's an interesting perspective because it's an autobiography. You know, there definitely is some, I think he tries to present himself in an accurate light. But you also know that you're not getting an outsider's perspective. So you have to read the book with that in mind. But one of the first things that I picked up on about Phil personally was that he was a very driven individual, you know, with some OCD tendencies, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. I mean, I think we've talked about this on a previous episode, but a lot of times the highest achievers in any walk of life tend to have some of those obsessive, compulsive type behavior patterns that help them focus in on one thing and not get tired of it and not want to move on, you know, have shiny objectitis. And that's definitely something that I picked up on about Phil pretty early on was, you know, as he's traveling around the world, the thing he's the most obsessed with is not the sights, the sounds, the food, the different cultures, it's the shoes. I found that to be an interesting window into his personality.
Yeah. And the other thing I found interesting was the word Nike. Correct me if I'm wrong, it's the Greek word for victory. And so long story, and we'll go through some of it, but he loves that word. He thinks about it all the time, but he doesn't actually start using it in his day-to-day life until his business is off the ground and he's seen some returns from it. And he got that while traveling around.
Yeah, yeah. It was interesting how he was able to kind of tie that thread in and really did have, you know, spent some time in Greece touring a lot of those historical sites where Nike was present. Nike, the Greek goddess of victory. So, so he starts Blue Ribbon Sports. He comes home, decides to go to Japan and reach out to a brand that made Tiger shoes and wants to become their distribution channel in the Western United States. Ends up founding kind of off the cuff. They ask him if he represents a company. He says, yes, Blue Ribbon Sports. What he doesn't tell them is that it just kind of was formed in an instant as he was sitting there in their boardroom. And Tiger agrees to allow Blue Ribbon to become their distribution channel on the West Coast. I thought it was interesting that he was very focused. Again, we're going to come back to this in several portions of the podcast, but Phil was very focused on what he wanted to do, and Blue Ribbon's goal was to provide better shoes for the running community. And when we say those words today in 2018, the running community is huge. Not so 45 years ago when Blue Ribbon / Nike was founded. You know, running was really in its infancy. Nobody really knew how to train. You know, it was being driven by eccentric characters like Bill Bowerman. It was really in its infancy, and it wasn't something that the culture embraced as an ideal. People didn't just go out and go running. It just wasn't done, which is odd. I had a hard time even imagining that type of a culture, because what we live in today, we're all about athleisure and athletic wear and running and sports and everything else. And that just, it was a very different culture in the late 60s, early 70s.
Yeah, I did think the same thing, thinking through. It's like, wait, you mean there was no people running alongside the freeway as you're going down and you're like honking at them? Yeah, honestly, and as you read the book and go to follow his story, you can see how he and Bill Bowerman, especially Bill Bowerman, was essential in the growth of that mindset that we have now. Bill Bowerman came out with the waffle pattern for your shoes, for the track on the bottom of your shoes. He came up with the material the style of material that they use for track and field, the rubber mat they use on the track and field now. He came up with some of the finest techniques, and he categorized them all into a book for running, for training. He created how a lot of Olympic athletes train these days. It's just they weren't really discovering these things that long, but they were categorizing them and cataloging them in a way so everyone else could have easy access to them.
Yeah. And another thread that we're going to see here is that Phil had the good fortune or the wisdom to surround himself with a team of really unique, loyal, and extremely talented characters. And I think it's easy to kind of apply revisionist history to things like this and just say, well, Phil obviously knew that there was greatness in all these guys. It's pretty clear in reading the book. Sometimes he saw that greatness in people. Sometimes those people, I mean, for lack of a better term, glommed onto him. I'm thinking of Jeff Johnson, who was a fellow runner and kind of his first employee. But he did have an eye for recognizing talent and surrounding himself with people that were hugely influential, not just in the first 2 or 3 years, but in the first 30 years of the company's existence, and really were instrumental in shaping Nike into the company that it is today, starting with Bill Bowerman. And I think that that's something that's really important to recognize, is you can only go so far by yourself. And surrounding yourself with talented, driven, and loyal people is crucial to long-term success in any entrepreneurial endeavor.
Yeah, I noticed that one pattern that stuck out to me was that he took people for salespeople. He took people that loved running and loved sports as much as he did and gave them opportunities and positions that they could share that with other people who love running and love sport. And then he took, like, his right-hand man was paralyzed from the waist down in a wheelchair, but that guy loved reaching out to people. He loved the chance to use his head and be able to share the love of sports with other people. And so he gave him opportunity to do that in a way he wouldn't have anywhere else. When it came to Bill Bowerman, he looked to him because he loved trying to find better ways for athletes to perform. And so that was a perfect partner to have, because he's always looking for better ways. His salespeople loved talking and sharing this love with other people. So that's perfect for sales. His office people loved organization and making like getting products to people and using their gifts and abilities to do that. So he, one thing he did do well was find a way to take the people with what they were, they loved, put them in positions where they were able to shine.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And, you know, we were talking earlier about the running culture or even sports culture in general that's omnipresent today in America. I think it's fair to say that Phil Knight is responsible for a lot of that culture in both its negative and in positive aspects. And it was by harnessing that love of competition and that drive to perfect your own technique, to push yourself beyond your limits, that he loved, kind of that athlete ethos that he talks about at some length, and create a fraternity of people, a tribe, as it were, of people that identified with that and then would go out and basically evangelize his product for him. But he didn't do it to evangelize his product. He did it for that fraternity, for that feeling of brotherhood that he talks about in several different places. And I thought that was a great example of how he went out to serve a community, to create a community. He didn't go out to make a ton of money. And that's not saying that making a ton of money is bad or that having that as your goal is bad. I'm sure he wanted to make a ton of money. But his success wasn't driven by him trying to make as much money as possible, I guess is what I'm trying to get at.
Yeah. Came down, he created a culture where people could express their love for the minute details of a sport. And he made his stores as sports havens where people come in and hear and touch nothing but sport. And that was, like you said, that was his goal. That was, he wanted some place where people could just share their love for the sport and what they were doing and not focus completely on money. He was focused on money because he had a lot of money issues starting out. He had to borrow money from his dad until his dad was just like, all right, enough, no more. And then he had to go to banks, and he slowly burnt through banks until each one would be like, all right, yeah, no more. Can't do it anymore. And that's the other interesting thing, is nowadays people would be banks and investment firms would love having someone with his growth on their side. But back in that day, they're like, what, you're doubling your sales? No, that's way too much growth. You need to cut it back a little.
Well, I couldn't help but think of Amazon. I mean, how many years was it before Amazon turned a profit? I mean, it was forever. And yet their stock price went up. The company became one of the more valuable companies in America and the entire world. And this is just 30 years after Nike, but Nike, you know, their entire first 15 years of existence, it's basically one protracted struggle for financing.
Yeah.
Just a very different world. Before we skip over or move past the very beginning, one thing that stood out to me is he comes back from his world tour with some shoes from Tiger. He gives them to Bill Bowerman to get his thoughts and opinion on the shoes. And Bill comes to him and wants in on the deal, as he calls it. They're eating hamburgers in a diner in Oregon. Bill wants in on the deal, and they agree to a 50-50 split. I thought Bill exercised a ton of wisdom after that by getting a legal contract written, first of all, and then recognizing that 50-50 is not a good way to run a company. There needs to be one boss and one leader, and so he voluntarily gave a symbolic 1% to Phil so that Phil had full operational control, even though they viewed themselves internally as partners. I think that that's very important. We've talked about this in Turn That Ship Around in several other books that we've covered, the importance of a clear line of leadership and that authority is clearly delineated. And I think that Bill had a ton of foresight in recognizing that Phil had the vision and the dream, and he had the technical expertise, which automatically should put Phil in the forward-looking role. That Bill needed to give him that control and the ability to decide the future of Blue Ribbon, which then turned into Nike.
I wonder, because Bill Bowerman fought in, so I think it was World War II in Italy. And so I'm wondering whether that recognition of, hey, there needs to be some chain of command or there needs to be some hierarchy here or else no one's ever going to get anywhere. I wonder if that had something to do with it.
Yeah. Yeah. Very, very well could. yeah, just that struck out. That stood out to me as something that just a good takeaway from this book, the importance of making sure there's a clear leader. Any army that has two generals, they're going to lose. That's pretty much a universal lesson from history. So,
yeah. Well, a man cannot serve two masters.
Yep. I mean, there's so many of those axioms that pervade our culture. And yet so often we find ourselves in relationships, in government, in family life, trying to make everybody equal and the exact same. And everybody has the exact same voice. And that's a recipe for disaster, especially when it comes to leading and running a company.
So going back to, or moving on, I should say, to his near constant cash flow issues, what were your thoughts on those?
I thought it was really interesting that his strategy was more avoidance. Now, there was definitely, I mean, he could only avoid it for so long, but it was kind of this nagging issue that was just always in the background and definitely affected him at a pretty personal level. And I think maybe laid the groundwork for some of the issues with his sons that cropped up as his sons grew older. It just, you could tell reading it that it's an emotional burden that he really didn't like talking about, reading the book. It was just this dark cloud. And they kind of played hide the pea for a long time between their different investment firms and funds and the banks and trying to get everybody paid on time. But through it all, again, coming back to being driven and focused, he didn't let those money issues sidetrack them from their goal of providing a better running shoe for the American public. They were always pushing forward, and they were never letting that admittedly large obstacle stop them from acting on their goal. I thought that was interesting how it had such an effect on him personally, and yet he did his best to shut it out from the operations of the company and continue charging forward as best they could.
Yeah, I kind of got the same thing with the personal side. I thought it was interesting how growing up, he didn't have the best relationship with his dad. They had some struggles. They didn't always see eye to eye. His dad was very much on the, we need to be respectable. We don't do this crazy shoe idea. We don't do this crazy idea, as Phil would call it when he's talking to his dad. But as time goes on, and his dad saw that this was really what his son wanted to do, and his son was willing to share these details and talk through different stuff with him, especially the money things, and later down the road, legal issues they were having as people are suing him. And it really brought his relationship with his dad a lot closer and tighter. But then, like you said, I think it probably also drove his relationship with his sons apart.
Yeah, and I think that the lesson, or at least something that I noticed and that I want to be sure that I watch out for in my own professional / family life, is that you're not letting your professional, your work life have a huge or an outsized impact on your life as a whole. And he definitely, part of the downside of being so focused and driven is Nike was his baby. Nike was his child that he gave all of his attention to, consumed not just his energy while he was at work, but consumed all of his emotional energy. He poured everything, literally everything he had, into making the company a success. And there was a lot of rewards that came with that, not just the money. A lot of the relationships that he built and friendships that he made and people that he was able to impact. But I think you see the effect in his sons. And we'll get into that towards the end here. But just an interesting dichotomy, and something that in my own life, I want to make sure that if I'm having a rough time at work, that I'm not letting that bleed in an outsized way into the rest of my life and impact the amount of time or the quality of time that I spend with family and friends.
Right. Yeah, that's a very important aspect of that. And also with the money issues they had, and as you were saying that they did push it to the back a lot, they also talked about it consistently. Every so often it'd come up and be like, hey, we don't know if we're going to make it. We might run out of money this time around. But as long as we have learned something, we'll be happy. we did something good, we learned something out of it, we'll be happy. So they did push it to the back a lot, which affected them and especially him, but they also brought it up consistently saying, hey, if we go down, did we learn something? Did we grow? Yeah. All right. Then we succeeded.
And that was kind of a revolutionary management style at the time. That language sounds very familiar to us today. That's the vernacular of the tech world, Silicon Valley, you know, moving into fintech and in the financial world. Everybody's talking about being lean and agile and learning from mistakes and making mistakes and growing. And it's just important for us to realize that was not the 1970s. The 1970s were very much Phil's dad. It was all about being respectable. It was about delivering profits. This was the heyday of GE and Sears. You know, these corporations that were the American way until very recently. This was their golden age, and it was all about what kind of dividend can you give to your investors. And that was not the ethos of Nike or Phil Knight.
Yeah, like we said earlier, he was light years ahead of his time, and in a sense, he helped usher the place we're in now in. He helped bridge that equity stage of banking and business to the investment side. And he talks about it. After all the banks turned him down, he was phoning banks left and right, going and visiting banks. He had to go to a Japanese investment company to get money to cover shipments and to keep growing and keep moving on. And so, I mean, so in a way, he did. He bridged that gap from then to now.
And in some pretty creative ways. I mean, and that was the other takeaway that I had with some of their cash issues was they got pretty creative. They didn't let the problem halt them. They continually sought workarounds and solutions, even if they were just temporary. And they came up with some really crazy ideas to make it work. And again, back to focus. He was driven. He wasn't going to accept failure as an option. And they continually found a way to succeed.
And one thing that they used to get ideas on how to exceed and stuff is they would watch the tech companies for insight on market trends, dollar trends, manufacturing trends. And so as they were watching the technology sector and as they saw the manufacturing costs rise in Japan with cameras and electronics, or they recognize that, oh, manufacturing prices are going to go up for us in Japan. We got to search other places so we have backups. So they went to Taiwan, they went to Mexico, and they got these backup factories, which helped also broaden out their chain and their whole supply. So that was one thing that was interesting because when it came down to it, he started the company by watching Japanese camera companies take over United States markets. And he's like, why can't that be done with shoes? They have great shoes over there. Let's try that with the United States. So he did get a lot of insight by watching technology companies and markets for the trends and just riding those and using those for insight.
Yeah. Well, it was interesting. Just today, I was reading an article on global GDP growth, gross domestic product, and it had basically a GIF of the top 10 economies by GDP in the world from 1960 to today. And in 1960, Japan was number 10 on the top 10 world's largest economies, and they were less than 10% by GDP, the size of the U.S. economy. Now, the U.S. economy grew tremendously from the 60s till today at a pretty consistent rate. But Japan reinvented themselves from 1960 to about 1980. And by 1980, they were the world's second largest economy, and they had grown to be about half of the United States, and they were double the next largest economy. So just an incredible growth story. And it was interesting to juxtapose that mega trend, that macroeconomic trend, with what Phil Knight was experiencing with a rise in manufacturing costs and the need to go elsewhere to drive his costs down and how those trends intersected. I mean, he really rode the wave well, getting in at the ground floor and then moving to other cheaper countries for labor as Japan educated their workforce and moved into more of a consumer technology-based economy.
Yeah, it's really an eye-opening read watching the decisions he makes and how he makes them and what he watches to make those informed decisions.
We've talked a lot about Phil. What was maybe a significant positive and negative trait? I mean, we've talked a lot about his focus and his drive, but what stood out to you in a positive and a negative light as you read their book, Brad?
For positive, he focused on people and what he believed in those people. He liked to see the good in people, and he was very, I want to say, trusting, the way I read it, in a lot of the people that he hired. He's like, all right, hey, I need a store opened in LA or whatever. Go do it. I don't really care how you do it. Just go do it. I trust you. That sort of stuff. And so that was positive. And I think people really benefited from his trust and the seeing the good in them and the positive in them. But the negative was he was just a horrible communicator. Just when it came to opening, when he opened up an office on the East Coast, he didn't even tell the guy that he picked to run the East Coast office that he picked him. He let the guy who he picked to replace that guy, the guy showed up in the store, and the Jeff Johnson was the guy who he picked to go to East. And Jeff was like, hey, what you doing here? He's like, oh, I'm your replacement. You're moving East. And Jeff is like, what? I had no clue. And just listening to the back and or Jeff Johnson attempts to communicate with him all in the early years of Blue Ribbon and even when Nike was going, he did not communicate well with any of his employees and even his family. It just wasn't his thing, unfortunately. I think he could have saved himself a lot of heartache and struggles that way.
Yeah. And I think what you said there on both the positive and the negative side are linked. You know, positively, he gave his employees, his trusted friends and partners, the freedom to go make decisions. And thankfully for him, he had picked individuals with enough talent and enough of that entrepreneurial spirit and drive that they could go out and flourish in that more laissez-faire management style. I was thinking about the article that we just covered on the importance of old school management techniques and providing guidance and check-in points and all that. And that definitely was not Phil Knight's style. And it worked for him because he hired the right kind of person that could work in that type of an environment. But even those folks got very frustrated by his poor communication style. I mean, it's hard to even call it a style as much as it just is a complete lack of communication. I continuously got the feeling that if we had a book written by Jeff Johnson, Bill Bowerman, and a couple of the other guys that formed the Buttface Group,
that's what they called the close top group that kind of ran the company. They'd have these, I think it was twice monthly outings of that, and where they just discuss everything company. No idea was too dumb. No idea was too crazy. Just everything was out on the table. That's what they called that group, that close knit group.
Yeah, but they, you know, all these folks, and they would get into. I think if the book was written by that group, you would see more of the negative sides. And I don't think that Phil is necessarily trying to whitewash his own image completely. I do think he's trying to be honest. It's just he has a different vantage point. I don't think working for him would have been a lot of fun unless you completely embraced the freedom that you had to go out and make decisions and you bought into the vision of Phil and the vision of what Nike could become as a whole and made that your own personal mission. And that's why Nike succeeded, is that group of men bought into the vision. They bought into the vision. They had tremendous loyalty to Nike and to Phil, and they were able to be very effective in their own capacities.
So one of the things that Phil did a lot was read. He read extreme amount. I don't think he goes into as much detail as I kind of wish he had on what books he read, but he was a huge reader on war literature and like biographies of generals and battles and strategies of different armies. And one, I think it was from General Patton, he said, don't tell people how to do things. Tell people what to do and let them surprise you. And he gave that quote several times in the book. It had to be at least four or five. And I think he modeled a lot of his leadership off of that. That quote really stuck in his mind. He loved the way Patton ran things. And so I think he really took that idea and implemented it into his company, which in some ways, like you just said, was good. In other ways, was bad.
Yeah. I think we need to do a book, a biography of George Patton at some point, because that guy is a quote machine and really was an inspiration to a lot of the business leaders of the last 30 or 40 years. I was thinking of his other quote, a good plan violently executed now is better than a perfect plan executed next week. There's just a lot of pithy truths coming from George Patton that I think he's going on our list. So anyways.
That is one of my top favorite quotes, and I kind of use that at work in my massive action attempts. When I just, that whole mindset, I'm like, we need a cable tensioner quick release. I'm like, all right, let's make it out of Legos. It's like, well, it's not the best plan, but it's a plan. Let's just do it.
Action is better than nothing at all. Well, at the end of the book, I found it to be actually kind of emotionally moving. He talks a lot about connections that were made with him and famous athletes, and even some that maybe aren't quite as famous, but talks about the personal effects that the Nike ethos had forged between him and really famous people like Michael Jordan, Tiger Woods, other titans of sport. They managed to create a culture within the Nike family. What I mean by that is the Nike company and their the sponsors that they signed, or the athletes that they signed to sponsor them, that just seems abnormal for that type of a business relationship, whether it's within a company or with those outside. What do you attribute that to? And did you have a similar reaction as you were reading that part of the book?
No, actually, I think I have the opposite of you. Is I started kind of phasing out of that part of the book, and I was like, I mean, I don't know. My mind was just like, okay, yeah, this is kind of where they're at. They're here now. They've arrived. In my mind, I'm more interested in the path to there. But I think it's mainly the whole Nike family between management and athletes and stuff like that. I think it's the faith they have in each other and their abilities, and just the belief they have that, hey, you can do it. We're willing to put our money behind you. We're willing to put our reputation behind you because that's how much we believe in you, and we know that you have the ability to do it. And for athletes, that can go miles, literally miles, when they are starting out. I mean, to have a young athlete have this huge company come up behind him and say, hey, we want to pay you to wear our stuff because we believe our stuff will help you out, and we know that you have it in you to go far. That's a lot for an athlete. And then for within management, they listen to each other and they're willing to consider each other's ideas, and they create a place where they can be honest with each other. It's not like a closed box, only give what your best ideas. It's just a different mindset than most companies have.
Yeah, they were committed because of Phil Knight's complete absence of communication. Whenever they got together for their planning sessions, their butt face conventions, and on a biannual basis, they had a culture of just being completely and often brutally honest with each other in ways that ultimately proved very productive, I think. And I think there's better ways maybe to go about creating that. But ultimately you want there to be an organic communication style within an organization that leads to transparency and honesty. If you aren't able to point out your issues and talk about them, you're not going to be able to solve them, and you're not going to be able to get enough brains on the issue at hand to come up with a solution that'll actually work most of the time anyways. I think that was something really important. And that honesty, that transparency plays over into the relationship side of it as well. So, you know, after reading the book, did you have anything that stood out? You know, if you were able to talk to Phil Knight, was there anything that you would have wanted clarified or a question that you wanted to ask? Anything come to mind for you, Brad?
Yeah, I actually had a couple questions. First of all, what was his top three favorite books? I mean, he talks about reading a lot of books, and at one point he mentions how Jeff Johnson reads like 10 times as many as he did. He was talking about how amazed he was walking into his apartment and be like, this is wall-to-wall books everywhere. The table's being held up by books. Piece of plywood stuck over four stacks of books. So I would mind knowing what his top three favorite books are. And then second of all, what lesson in business sticks with him to this day? And does he think that everyone wanting to have their own business should learn? Like, what if there's a top thing that just sticks in his head that he thinks of quite often that he learned while doing business? What is it? And he talks about a lot of things he learned, but I'd just be curious his answer to that question.
I think for me, I would want to ask him, what was your biggest failure? As you look like, because he's experienced tremendous success in almost every area of life. But he also, he did have some not great chapters in his life as well. And so I would like to know, just to get to know him better as a person, what was your biggest failure? And how, if you could go back and fix it, how would you? I think that would, if he would answer that openly, that would be a very thought-provoking discussion, learning from somebody who's lived a very full life. And what was his biggest regret? What was his biggest failure? Anything else that you wanted to cover here before we get into recommendations and applications?
I thought it was interesting. So he was sued several times, and he had more legal troubles than any business would ever want to have. He got sued by overseas companies, domestic companies, and the U.S. government. And so he had the whole spectrum. And I thought it was very interesting how through it all, it wasn't like they just at one point gave up and said, hey, we're being told by U.S. government we need to give them a check for $23 million right now. They didn't give up. They were just like, all right, we'll figure that out. Hey, do you guys want to buy a pair of shoes? Yeah, they just kept right at it. And they didn't let that even really phase them. And at the same time, they trusted the people they put in their legal teams to do their job. They weren't hovering over their shoulder at every point saying, yeah, but I still want to take them down and stick it to the man by doing this. They were just like trusting, even if the people were new, untested, untried in the legal sphere, they still trusted them. They're like, hey, this is your job. We sell shoes. You do legal stuff. We'll let you do legal stuff. You let us know if you need anything. We'll be over here selling shoes.
Yep. Again, finding people with talent, putting them to work, utilizing their talents, and focusing on your own core competencies. Recipe for success. And something that as we read more of these books, I think we're going to see that theme repeated. I'm excited to do more, you know, business history style books, whether they're biographies or not. And one of the things I'm looking forward to is just seeing themes repeated. And I think that that one in particular is going to be a theme that we see quite often. So, with that, moving on to recommendations. Brad, we've talked about this book, man, for almost an hour now. Would you recommend Shoe Dog to who and how strongly?
Yes, I would recommend it to people who think that there's such thing as overnight successes, because this really shows how much work goes into success. If you think about it, they exploded relatively quickly in the long scheme of things, from, it took them about, I don't know, what was it, 4 or 5 years to get to $1 million worth of sales. But in reality, they were still cash broke. And so I would, for anyone wanting to start their own business and thinking, hey, I can just push this off the ground, immediately get going, I'd really give it to them and say, hey, listen to it. It's an easy listen. Or if you really want to read it. It's a really easy read, relatively shortish when it comes to biographies, but really focuses in on how much work goes into the success he has made and the sacrifices he's made. We haven't talked much about it because he sacrificed a lot with his kids. I think you mentioned it a little before with his sons. And so I would really recommend those people. I'd recommend it to anyone because it's amusing. It's in some spots, it's sad in other spots. And he was really good at chronicling his life. I think he didn't really talk about it much, but I think he kept journals throughout most of it. And so you can learn a lot from seeing what he did and learning from his mistakes and victories. I'd heartily recommend it.
Yeah. Yeah. I would agree. I echo what you said about it not being an overnight success. He founded Blue Ribbon Sports in 1964. And while I'm sure he made decent money through the life of that, they really didn't see any significant financial reward and really weren't profitable until like 1979, 1980 when they went public. And even then, they still had a lot of growing to do between then and where they are today. So a ton of work. You really get a good sense of the amount of time and energy, both physical and mental, that went into birthing Nike. And it was a ton of hard work. He really he had massive goals. He 10x'd his goals. And you see that played out in the sacrifices he had to make, the effort he had to put forth, and then you see the reward that there was there at the end. So overall, I would highly recommend this book. I found it to be an entertaining read, and a story that I didn't want to put down. When I first read it, I will go to Barnes & Noble after I complete my sales call for the day from time to time to use their Wi-Fi and send out some emails and then maybe read a book or two or a couple chapters here and there. And I went to Barnes & Noble after work three nights in a row one week to finish this book there in the store. Really, really enjoyed it. Grabbed my attention, and I now own a copy. It's one of the few books that we've covered that I actually bought a physical copy for my personal library.
Wow.
So would highly recommend it. Application, Brad, go.
Don't worry about being the underdog. If you believe in what you're doing and are meeting a need and people love your solution to that need, then do it. Don't stop. Just go for it. And if you for some reason have to stop at some point, if or forced to stop, and just make sure you've learned something, that you've grown as a human being and in who you are. Yeah, just don't stop pushing for it. That you can be the underdog for 25 years and all, quote unquote, all of a sudden break out and be the top contender. So
I think for me, there was a lot of takeaways that I could have put in this space. But we touched on this a little bit earlier. Being creative and having an overcoming attitude in the face of seemingly insurmountable obstacles. Find a way. Be creative. Look outside the box. Blow the box up. I think that mentality is so crucial because failure will come. Problems will arise. We've all experienced those and we will continue to experience those. But do you have the ability to get up after you've been hit in the face and keep going, keep plowing forward? That was probably my biggest application from this book, was that tenacious mentality of we will succeed. We just need to figure out a better way. And they figured it out.
He said at one point, if you see only problems, then you're not thinking properly. Good paraphrase you had there of that one.
Awesome. Very cool. Well, really enjoyed recording this episode with you, Brad. I hope our audience finds this helpful and entertaining. If you want a copy of Shoe Dog, you can pick this up at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Audible.com, wherever you like to obtain your books. If you enjoyed today's episode, it would really help us out if you'd leave us a rating on iTunes or wherever you downloaded the podcast and a review. We love getting feedback from our listening audience and look forward to continuing to serve you guys better and provide hopefully helpful content covering a wide variety of subjects here. Our next book is going to be a classic in the business world, 7 Habits of Highly Effective People by Stephen Covey, first released in 1989. A lot of people have recommended this book to us. I personally haven't read it yet. I've read some excerpts from it, but I have a copy now. I'm excited to be sitting down and getting into 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. That'll be the next book that we review. And between now and then, we'll probably release at least one, maybe two article podcasts as well. So, anything else from your side of the glass, Mr. Brad Luce?
Yeah, so we are, just a reminder to everyone, we are on Instagram, Twitter. We have an email, reviewimprove@gmail.com. I think my Twitter handle is brad.luce. Sam, yours? @SamRust. We're both on Goodreads, so you can check out what books we've read on there and what we recommend, what we want to read, stuff like that down the road. Yeah, so find us on there, link up with us, do what you do on social media. I guess we'll catch you all later.
Awesome. Well, thanks again for tuning in, folks. We'll catch you next time around. This is your host, Sam Russ, signing off.